Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I am joined by golf course architect Andy Staples. Andy is a young, up-and-coming architect who has designed courses such as Meadowbrook Country Club, Sand Hollow, and Rockwind Community Links. Our discussion jumps right into a talk on municipal golf, or as Andy likes to call it, community golf. And then we divulge into his renovation of Meadowbrook, Willie Park Jr., and much more. Thanks for all the ongoing support and for tuning in. And if you haven't yet, please rate and review the podcast in iTunes and subscribe if you don't already. Here's Andy Staples.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
How did I get roped into Muni Golf?
Yeah.
I love it. Well, I would tell you that the Muni sector in our business was where a lot of the blue collar architects would play for a lot of years. I think maybe still today. And, you know, we didn't get the calls from the top clubs when I first got in the business. So I ended up seeing a lot of that side. So I responded to a lot of RFPs, you know, really as long as I've been in the business. And so it was somewhat natural to me, but it was always known as this, you know, faction of the business that you're like, well, one day we might graduate and not have to do this. And then the recession hit and the Muni sector was hit as hard as anybody. And it felt like it was something that was real to me and understood. And then on top of that, it just felt, you know, innovation in golf is not a word you hear a lot of, maybe in the equipment side, but not on the development side. And so I felt that there was some room for innovation. And I didn't like the word municipal. And I thought community was a lot better word. And I said, you know what, I think this is a place for innovation and a place to make a mark. And I thought it was also a place that a lot of my competitors it was a pond that they weren't fishing in. And so I went full bore. And lo and behold, I find myself being pretty successful in front of a large group and comfortable in front of a large group and been able to kind of bring people onto the side of golf. And it just has been something that I've stuck with. And I think I'm passionate about it. And I think it's the value of a golf course in a community is not something that is really well thought of. And I think we should be thinking more of it as a value. And it's been kind of a mission of mine to stick with it.
That's kind of what I see too, is like something that fascinates me is how many of my podcast guests grew up playing municipal golf, like it, and how many of the people that get into the golf industry grew up playing muni golf. And it I mean, it's so vital. Like I grew up playing muni golf. Like without muni golf, if you want to talk about growing the game, like if Muni Golf keeps closing and on its pace that it is now, like you're not going to have a game without it.
Yeah. I think if you go back to the history of why municipal golf even started, go back to, you know, Van Cortlandt Golf Course, the first municipally owned golf course in the country. It was a place for, you know, the growing middle class that had some expendable income that couldn't afford to join a private club. They went down to the local municipal golf course. So I think it's, you know, people don't realize that the reason why golf is the way that it is and the way that it was able to expand to the heights that it got expanded to was because of municipal golf, or at least in part because of municipal golf. Yeah, I was the same way. I grew up playing at a place called Wanaki in outside of Milwaukee in Wisconsin. Wanaki Golf Course. It was a county, Waukesha County golf course. And I would meet my buddies down there after school and we'd play on the weekends. It was the same thing, you know, $4 or $5 for somebody under 16. And, you know, it was easy for the parents to drop us all off. So it was, yeah, I think municipal golf means a lot to a lot of golfers. And I think, you know, in today's world, we're municipal golf is taking such a kind of a, such a back seat and kind of a getting abused and in the media, whether or not municipalities should be in the golf business. And I contend that it should.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know. It frustrates me because those courses were built kind of seemingly all at like a really bad time. So they, you know, for the most part, a municipal golf course is like the least innovative golf course that you'll see. It's, you know, they're pretty cookie cutter and pretty unimaginative. And I think if they, at the time when they were built, golf was so exclusive and they're missing the inclusive nature of a community course.
Well, yeah, a lot of those courses are integrated into the fabric of the county or city park system. So I think it was just kind of part and parcel. You'd have open space, you'd have trails, you'd have camping, you'd have maybe a lake or something, and then you have a golf course. So it's the inclusivity of golf and the community nature of golf has been there. And I'm one to believe that the community golf is at the very beginning of a complete revitalization. And I'm not equating that with all kinds of people playing golf, but the golf course, municipal golf course industry, I think is just prime for a pivot. And there's just too many of them out there. And there's too many success stories and too many good models that are being followed today that I think it's just at the beginning of a new awareness of golf, what I like to call community golf. I'd rather not call it municipal golf anymore because I think we all think of that as a negative term, because you can have a great, you know, really interesting strategic golf course and turns people through and maintain for a reasonable budget.
It seems like that a better, more well-designed golf course would be way more beneficial for a community because you'd be able to get people around it faster. They'd have more fun and it'd be more beginner friendly, while it'd be way more interesting for an expert player.
Yeah, I think that's what business right now is. What exactly is the right balance of strategy and heroic design? And some might call it, you know, we went through a period of penal design, balancing the right level of challenge with just letting people have fun and play the game. And I think that, you know, when I was brought to the game, I actually learned on a Bill Langford golf course, a Langford Moreau golf course, West Bend Country Club, a little blue collar club out suburbs of Milwaukee. And I remember hitting into these big, huge grass features. I started at seven, eight years old. And by the time I was 10, I still couldn't get out of these things. I would ricochet off the grass faces. And I remember thinking, gosh, I better practice. I better get better at this. This isn't an easy game. And so I think there's a part of that we all as golfers like the challenge, but I think that there's ways, I think we went overboard. I think there's a way to balance the challenge and the strategy and the interest, to truly kind of defend the course against a better player, but let people play through it in a reasonable amount of time.
So
definitely an opportunity.
You grew up playing golf and did you play in high school?
Yeah, I played in high school. I was on the high school team. I was on the state championship team. Actually, I guess maybe claim to fame. I played with Mark Wilson, the tour pro. He was a freshman. I was a senior. We won state. And I actually had thoughts of trying to play golf in college one day, and I realized that probably wasn't going to happen. I got in front of that kind of competition and realized that's when you get separated, right? I had a better chance of drawing pictures of a golf course one day as opposed to playing them for a living.
So you went to school and you studied, you wanted to be a golf course architect from, you know, the day you stepped into school?
Yeah, so when I was practicing every day. I got the bug when I was a kid through high school, and my dad saw the level of interest, and I actually started building my own golf course out of a sand beach in northern Wisconsin, and my dad saw me tending to it every weekend, and he said, you know, son, people design golf courses for a living. And I said, that was the time, I think it was around 12, I was like, that just blew my mind. I had no idea that was even possible. I thought golf courses just appeared. And at that point I said, well, how do I do that? And of course my dad said, I don't know. And so he did some calling around and told me that I should go study. You know, the idea at the time was to go study landscape architecture in school. And so I said right then, I'm going to go to school to study landscape architecture. So as soon as I got into school, you know, everybody was trying to, in my department, building buildings or designing parks or, you know, working in urban planning. And I was the lone golf course guy. You know, at the University of Arkansas is where I went. So that was a team that I tried to walk on, the golf team, but realized that, you know, the coach at the time said, he asked me what I was studying. And I said, I'm studying landscape architecture. I want to be a golf course architect when I grow up. And he says, well, you realize that you either play golf or study architecture. You don't do both here. I'm like, okay, well, that's a pretty clear, that's an easy decision for me. So I thought I knew about 12 years old that there was such a thing and that's what I wanted to do. I feel very fortunate for that.
That's neat. I always think back to my childhood and I remember there was a Microsoft golf game that you could design your own golf course. And I would do that all the time. And then my buddy and I would play wiffle ball in our street, in our front yards. And we'd, you know, essentially design golf holes in our own way, playing from tree to tree. It's amazing the imagination of a kid. I bet your philosophies of golf course design have changed a little bit.
Yeah. I of course did the same thing, hitting off trees, and you know, I had a sand green, so this was I had a little cup in my little sand green. But yeah, I remember the first time, you know, this Wanakee, this county course I was telling you about, had a bunch of hanging lakes. So you would go up over a ridge and you'd hit it over the top of the ridge and then you'd come to the top and realize there was a pond there. You're like, shoot, there's a pond. I just hit it in the water.
Blind
I had
water.
No idea. I couldn't see. It was a blind lake, right? And so me as a young golfer, well, I should have known that there was a lake. I should have been able to see through that ridge. Well, the first time I realized that somebody actually placed a lake there as a designer, things started to go off in my mind like, why in the world would you put it there? Then, of course, now you're blaming the designer, not your own game, of course. But yeah, it's certainly changed and evolved as you educate yourself through the business and through time, for sure.
So after you get out of school, where'd you go work right off the? How'd you get kind of into the architecture industry? I imagine it being somebody that came out in the 90s, it was booming.
Yeah. So yeah, I started working. I had a mentor through school. We did as part of my thesis, I did a design of a golf course on top of a landfill. And I worked with a guy named Jerry Slack out of Tulsa, which was he was more of a land planner. He was a golf course architect in his own right. But he was the one that said, if you really want to start in this business, go work in construction. So this was probably in 1993, 94. And so my first job was really working with Wadsworth Golf Construction. I started up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and then down into Texas. And so really my entree to the business was through the construction world. And then Jerry, once he saw that I had kind of followed his path or his preferred path, he hired me to become a draftsman. And so I was drawing. My first job was drawing plans by hand. It was before we had CAD or any type of computer. I remember helping him through the first computer we bought to try to get CAD in the office. But so that was in Tulsa. That's how I kind of broke in the business. So I like to say that I wouldn't have gotten that job had I not started on the construction side.
That makes sense. I mean, back then, construction was like the thing. I mean, what was it, a golf course a day that everybody was saying that America needed to build to keep up with the pace of the growing game?
That's right. The NGF said golf course a day, and we tried. We definitely tried. For a while, we were doing, what, one year we did 500 golf courses in a year?
I mean, it goes back to the, you know, current state. Everybody associates golf courses closing with bad, but, you know, and munis closing with bad, but I think part of it is just a market normalizing to what it should be.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, the idea that we were building that kind of quantity over that short a period of time is really, now looking back on it, pretty mind-blowing that even was possible. So I'm a firm believer. It's one of my messages as I talk to the municipal sector that I talk to, is that, you know what, closing your golf course is a real option. So let's talk about that for a second. You know, before we even go any further about improving your course, let's talk about, is there support for the course and whether it should stay open? So I'm one that certainly is not against any closures, because there's a reason for why those courses aren't making it.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's courses that should close and there's courses that shouldn't close. And I think, there needs to be some sort of, at some point in the near future, some sort of initiative from the USGA to, use some of their money to support the ones that really shouldn't close. And that's what bugs me, is like some of these, you're familiar with Detroit area, but like that Rackham course that was on the brink of closing, like that's a course that, ton of history, Donald Ross design. It's tied very closely to the city. That's a course that shouldn't close. It might need to be a little bit different of a concept than it is currently and have a little bit forward thinking concepts, but that's a golf course that should be helped and subsidized from golf's governing body. What do you think about the USGA and Muni Golf?
Community golf, right? So what do I think? Do I think the USGA should be the one to step up into that? I don't think we're there at that point. I don't know that the municipal sector is positioned right to be able to take those kind of funds. It's like, the stimulus dollars just a couple of years ago, right? So, I understand trying to kickstart an industry and finding maybe some showcase properties that make some sense. And to be honest, I mean, that the way they've showcased it is around their Open Championship. That's been the way, they've brought it to the public sector. They brought the, the U.S. Open, rotation or courses to try to get, the golf under a certain, message that it's open to the public. But, in terms of putting money towards municipalities, you talk about Rackham. I mean, you got some other issues there with Rackham and it's not necessarily unique to the city of Detroit. It's unique to just this idea that the backing and the ability to support public golf, there's not enough people at the highest levels of their government that support golf. And so I think improperly support, and the city has the ability more times than not to support and subsidize golf. It's just they're choosing not to because of the messaging that's happening about the negativity towards golf. But when you start thinking about all the people that actually have a chance to visit a golf course, and that's one of my messages to my community golf message, is that it needs to expand the user group so that it's not just about the 10% that play golf, that it's more about walking trails and outdoor activities and any type of use. It's not necessarily a clubhouse anymore. It's more of a community building. If you start to pivot on those types of messages, I think the USGA's role can help support that. But I think if we look to them to try to save municipal golf, I don't know that I agree with that. But there's certainly a powerful message there that needs to be in support of municipal golf.
So getting into your community golf, and on your website, you've got just great resources, a white paper, and different things about, the way your kind of philosophy on what community golf should be. And I think what you said about inclusive is such a big deal. It's almost more of a model that you would see in England and Scotland and Ireland than what the traditional community or municipal community golf is in America, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's funny how many people, when I get in front of the municipal stakeholders and tell them about the old course at St. Andrews and the fact that it closes down on Sunday and becomes a park, people can walk across the entire, golf course and property, they're blown away. They're like, oh, I can't believe that. We love walking on golf courses. We should consider that, right? And so, it's funny how when you go throughout the world, I studied in Denmark for a semester, and the study focus was on urban planning, but we had a chance to go out to all kinds of park plans, and we studied throughout Scandinavia, including Stockholm and Sweden. And there was a specific park property called Woodland Cemetery. It was this broad open space. It wasn't a golf course. It was a cemetery, but it basically felt like a golf course. And you would go through a series of trails and transitions from space to space. There was chapels, there was auditoriums, there were crematoriums, there was open space to be outside in nature. And I think when people are drawn to that kind of experience, and for us as golfers, we happen to do that. We actually experience an open space with a stick and a ball in our possession. And so to me, when you just start to think about the innate characteristics of being outside and playing sport, you know, golf falls right in line with all of those things I think that we are drawn to. And, you know, so now it just tells me it's a messaging issue. It's how are we presenting it? And we should be presenting it not necessarily across the board. I understand that, you know, golf has many different faces, but from these particular community golf courses, they need to be presented, and the messaging needs to be proper and needs to start from the very beginning, the very top of government. And so I think we just need to – we have a marketing and a messaging issue as much as anything.
It's funny when you're thinking about – just thinking while you're talking, like something that just sticks out to me that's so, so simple that no – like barely any courses in America do is like, why can't my dog come with me? Like, you know how much easier it would be if you could take your dog out? Like, do you know how much easier it would be for me to get my wife out if our dog could come? Like, you know, it all of a sudden becomes more than, you know, you're spending time outside in a beautiful place. You know, it goes back to the landscape architecture. Like, I mean, there's so much, you know, you can do with a beautiful green space, a big, beautiful green space. And so you're kind of Rocklin Links is your big calling card for community golf. Explain to us a little bit about, you know, Rocklin as a golf course, but also a community center.
Sure. Yeah, so Rocklin Community Links is in Hobbs, New Mexico. It was host of an old military golf course built in the 40s. They did training sessions on the property right next. They were housing a military personnel on the property. They converted to a golf course, and it was just, I guess you could say, it was poorly built. And then on top of that, it was on a piece of rock. It's, you know, Rocklin. You know, they called it the Rock, Caliche Rock. So it was a typical municipally owned golf course that was, you know, deteriorating in front of everyone's eyes. They needed a new irrigation. They had a hard time, you know, having any quality turf. The soil wasn't great. And they kept coming up to the council to say, hey, we need to start putting some improvements to this. And each time, you know, it wasn't as if they were saying no, but they said that there was higher priorities before we start improving the golf course. So when I was introduced to the club, I was actually hired to do a little par three course. They wanted to do an assessment to say, hey, we see a lot of these beginner courses starting to say, we have an 18-hole golf course. We have a kind of sort of a driving range. It wasn't great. It had a net at the back of it. It was really short. But hey, let's talk about putting a short course. So part of, you know, my initial plan was just to build a little 9-hole, 12-hole par three course. And I said, well, guys, did you think about this? You know, because it was really disconnected and went through a bunch of different ideas. I said, well, actually, what we need to be thinking about is broadly, how is this facility attracting golfers and training them and transitioning them from the beginnings through on to the serious golfer? And I presented them the Community Links concept. I said, it isn't just about golfers anymore. Now we'll talk about developing people through life and family and those types of things. And the city manager at the time was listening to me, and he's like, you know what? That's interesting. I can sell that. And my council will buy into that. So we went in front of council, said, this is what we're thinking. And it turned from, you know, a simple irrigation project or a par three course to now the golf course becoming a central component of their entire community. That Hobbs is oil and gas driven. So timing is everything. They were seeing oil prices on the rise at the time, and a very pro golf mayor and a couple people on the council that played golf, not everybody, but a couple. So when we went in front of them and said, hey, before we go any farther, we want to see if you're interested in this. And we're really proud to say that every time we went in front of council with what we tried to do, we got 7-0 votes in favor that this golf course should become a central part of the city plan. And that this idea that we're going to diversify the user group to attract more than just golfers was tangible. They saw that. So we have a trail system. We've got an open. We built a 5-acre effluent water storage that the golf course here uses for irrigation, which then has an open space adjacent to it. So if the trail system connects to the through the clubhouse community center area, and then has a spot where golfers, non-golfers can actually watch people play golf. There's a par three real close across the water, so they can sit on a little seat wall. There's a nice big open green space next to the range, so that we have, kids programs. Snag Golf is a big part of what they do. Snag is now in all their schools as a part of this project. The community college plays there. So they have expandable outdoor event areas. So they put on symphonies, and this was basically the middle of the city. Now everything happens at their golf course, and it couldn't have come together any better. We had support from everybody across their level of government, and speaking of the USGA, they've labeled it as the model Muni, if you will, mm-hmm. for others to look at.
I think a lot of people, like, you go in and say, hey, like, you know, let's fix this golf course up. Let's, you know, make it this and this and this. So this course, needed obviously irrigation, which is a big, and it's a good timing piece for doing a project. But in terms of economics, like, you know, how can a muni look at this and say, it's not going to crush our bottom line with the project?
That's the biggest question I get. It's like, okay, well, great. You did that at Rockwind. There's no way we can do that here. Mm-hmm. And I always turn around and say, are you sure that you can't? So, you know, most every city is making some pretty major investments into quality of life. And so to me, it's about understanding what's important. And so the very first thing is a marketing and a messaging issue that I'll stand in front of the council and I'll say, okay, who here plays golf? And more than likely one or two out of seven or nine will raise their hand. I said, okay, well, who here has played golf? And then a couple more people raise the hand. And so to me, I immediately go back to the discussion that if we don't understand the value of what this golf course could mean to the city or the municipality or the area, the community, the county, then we shouldn't even be talking about anything. I would tell you that you should be considering closing this golf course. And then of course, everyone's like, no, we can't close this golf course. We have a lot of people that play golf here. Well, ultimately you only have, a few thousand rounds a year. And so I start to say, let's start building pride. So that's number one is messaging and support of golf. And then almost always there are practice facilities, short tees, open space that you can carve out. It's really challenging this idea that an 18-hole regulation course is what's right for cities across the country. So not every golf course needs to be 7,000 yards. A 6,200-yard golf course is just fine for a lot of people. So we look at kind of carving out spaces within the space to be able to do that. And then I also talk about it in terms of a roadmap. So this isn't going to happen over a short – doesn't always have to happen over a short period of time. It just needs to be – the messaging needs to be accurate. It needs to be repeated over and over and then implemented – at the pace that you guys feel is appropriate for funding. But if you're not going to fund it, then I would just tell you that you consider closing it.
Yeah. It seems like they got to get behind it or get out. And I think differentiation to me is something that always sticks out too, is that I've been dealing with this a little bit with the course I grew up playing is thinking about closing, and you look at the landscape and they're all the same golf course that were built in the same period in this just row of everything around it. And it's just like, of course, then all of a sudden it becomes price is the thing that you compete on because you're no different than everything else.
I wholeheartedly agree that in order for community golf to be successful, it has to be able to provide something that not anyone else is providing. So if you look around your golf landscape, you need to find what it is that the private business isn't providing or doesn't want to provide. So that's where these short courses, that's where the practice facilities and driving range concepts. That's why Top Golf, I think, is becoming so popular. It's providing something that the rest of the golf community's not giving everyone. And so as long as you can stand up and say that this is a course that's providing a benefit to my community in ways that the private market is not able to, then that's our niche. That's where the community golf starts to say, all right, then a $200,000 subsidy starts to make sense, because one, it's a smaller footprint, so we're using less resources, less dollars. Oh, by the way, you can play it much quicker, and it's able to attract an area that of the population that wouldn't necessarily go to that championship 18-hole 7,000-yard golf course.
I even think about it with the course I'm talking about. Like, in the area, there's no good driving ranges. Like, alone having a driving range, you're going, like, a really quality driving range, you're going to attract people that are members of the country clubs that have subpar driving ranges.
Yeah, it's quite interesting for me to look back on properties that were all built in this window that we're talking about in the 90s, how the driving range was, history says you were lucky to have a driving range, and then when you did, it was just for warm-up purposes. So it really wasn't really thought of as a place that people would come and just bang balls and, tear up turf and dig holes. They would basically take a couple of swings and go out and play golf. That entire mentality has shifted, and I talk a lot about this myself. That's my life. That's what makes sense to me. I don't go out and play 18 holes with my buddies anymore. I go out and play 4 or 5 holes with my kids. I got 3 young boys, and then I'll take them to the range to hit balls, and then I might take them in and get a soda, right? So that, or maybe putt on the green, then the soda. So that to me is a shift in how we use a golf course. And I think that is a real, if you don't have that, if you're not trending in that area and the practice facilities, the driving ranges, then I think you're missing out.
It's funny. I was talking to my buddy that I grew up playing this golf course with, and we played in high school together and grew up riding our bikes there, and we were the same guys that were chewing up our neighbor's lawn. But we talked, we had coffee, we were talking, and it's like we spent the most time on that course's putting green. And I you start to think about why. And it was massive. It was probably like a 10,000 square foot putting green. So we could do, and you could chip and everything. And we'd spend hours there, and we'd never get tired with it. It wasn't a great green, like in the sense of like, it wasn't like supremely interesting with contours, but what it was it was free. It was open, and it allowed us to it was a place we could just spend time.
Spend time with your friends.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, you think about it, it's like we spent more time on that putting green, chipping and putting, than we did playing the golf course.
Yep. Yeah. So the city manager got famous in Hobbs for saying, if a city is not too concerned about green fee, you can really start to grow the game. And this idea that you'd have a bucket of putters next to your putting green where there was a walking trail that someone might actually pull a putter and hit a ball because they've never done that before. The business mind in golf says, well, I should charge them for that. That should be a $5 putting course fee, right? And so this is back to this idea of community golf. I understand they're doing really good things like down in Winter Park. This idea that it's not all about a green fee and it's not all about revenue. Sometimes it's more about an asset and a quality of life and a spending time with your family discussion. And, those are the ways to do it. And it's proven. We just ignored it for 20 years. That's why I'm saying that I think that it's prime for a comeback.
Yeah. You look at golf and how it changes and how there's these different innovations. And the last big one was the minimalist movement that, Tom Doak and Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw started, with building golf courses that were much more lay of the ground and with the ground movement. And you start to think about like, what's going to be this next innovation with golf courses? And you have to look no further than an abundance of golf courses that were built that really don't fit needs or aren't any good. And it also makes me think about the residential golf courses that just aren't very good golf courses, but were built to make money, with residential developments. And that kind of fits into this. And I think reimagining those golf courses is what the future of golf course development is.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think it's going to be interesting because there's a lot of sticky parts to that because there's zoning regulations and open space and those types of things. But I couldn't agree more. And I think the idea that we're going to look back on courses like Sand Hills and a development like Bandon Dunes, we talk a lot about the dark ages of golf, but I think those will be the facilities that really, you know, we'll look back and saying that's where the golf industry turned to another direction. I can't help but think even some of these residential courses are going to have to then change away from just being a golf course. They're going to have to be more park open space because I just don't think those are the ones that aren't going to make it. I think everyone's proven that when you get out into open space, free of development and out in nature, that's when we really, really, that's when we know we really love golf.
A house on a golf course is like an immediate detractor for people. It's amazing.
It is.
I remember I was talking about Philly Cricket Club with somebody and somebody was like, you know, those condos on the 13th hole just ruin everything. And I'm like, wow, one hole, like having condos by there. But this guy, you know, he just was offended by those condos. I think that's part of the essence of golf is being out in the open and getting to, you know, disconnect from the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that whole idea of development and the right balance for all of those elements, you know, the one thing that I believe happened over a 20 or 30 year period is that the golf course wasn't the number one driver. So you chose sites that you wouldn't necessarily build a golf course by itself. It wasn't a great piece of land and you ended up, you know, moving a lot of dirt and you raised the houses on the outside and dropped the golf on the middle, the center. It just got to be repetitive and boring.
Tunnels.
Exactly. And it's still occurring. There's properties that are happening. I mean, there's a big development here in Phoenix going in. I was just at yesterday that, you know, they're building houses all over the place and there's a golf course in the middle of it. But what I found interesting about it is the clubhouse was not just a clubhouse. I walked in, the very first thing I saw was a bike rental shop. It was a clubhouse kind of built in a U. And so you saw bike rentals and then sea kayaks because you could actually take it out on a big lake that they were building. And then there's a whole open space that went off into the center of the property. And the very first thing you see as you walk in the back of the clubhouse was a big open outdoor seating area and then the driving range. So it was right in line with all the things that I'm talking about, that the driving range becomes more of a social center and people are hanging out. And you just go over, hit some balls and come back over here. So the residential part of this is, I don't think is necessarily going to go away entirely, but I think how we use some of these central spaces is definitely evolving.
Yeah, I heard a statistic that a golf course within walking distance of your home is worth like $10,000 to your home.
I don't know about that. That wouldn't surprise me.
That's just something I heard with this research I've been doing recently, which it's crazy. But you think about like these big residential, like why doesn't the clubhouse have like a coffee shop? You know, if I live like down the street, like I'm going to go there rather than I'm going to go like spend 10 minutes in my car going to get coffee.
Yeah, I think you're kind of touching on some of the things that I've been in the middle of. You know, it's one thing to be talking about a message. It's another thing to actually implement mm-hmm. that message. And, you know, so our golf business, if you will, is really, they've got the management companies and the operators, they've got it pretty well oiled to a golf business. So they know golf. What they're not really good at is, or not, I mean, they can be, they just haven't chosen to be good at doing other things like coffee houses, bike rentals. They don't understand it. So now how do you position the economic there for these guys that actually can come in and diversify the user without having the risk of losing? That's an interesting part of this. I talked to a management company a lot about this, and he says, well, Andy, this all sounds great. I love the community links concept, but right now no one's hiring us to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to change that.
Yeah. So working with a municipality versus a private club, like what are the differences that you see?
Do you have enough time? Let me start with some of the similarities. So the similarities are, there's always a discussion about money. There's always a discussion about budget, and there's always a discussion about downtime and disturbance. And so there's certainly some similarities that across, you know, both types of projects. Probably the biggest difference with the municipality, the community golf perspective, is just all of the other buy-in that has to happen. It's just takes longer to make decisions, and more people have to weigh in. And that's one of the things that I think that I've done well at, and I kind of promote myself as, is I've got the patience to kind of go through that. I'm not going anywhere. So this doesn't have to happen in 6 months. It can happen in 12 months, or I don't like to take too long, but. And so the stakeholder buy-in, the meetings, to the town hall meetings, negotiating certain aspects of the plan, you know, this is where you start to see, you know, if I kind of diverge a little bit, you see what a golfer really looks like. You know, when you're in a town hall of 120, 150 people, and you have half golfers, half non-golfers, you start to see how we as a group, as a golfing group, react. And I got to be honest, you know, the golfers are not very organized. They're not, they come in, they say, this is our golf course. And then if they're upset, they'll leave. A lot of golfers will walk out. They'll say they're never coming back. You know, whereas the mountain bike association or the equestrian, you know, they'll come up with a PowerPoint presentation. They'll present everything to us very matter of factly. And when you actually look back and you start to see how the process is going, you know, I find myself defending golf just from a group standpoint, you know, not necessarily just me individually or what I'm trying to do. And so, you know, managing all those different type of community uses is by far the difference, the big difference. But I will say, is from a private club membership, is you still have opinions, but generally it's really driven by, you know, by being a member at that club.
Mm-hmm. That's, I think, like one of the things in my experience with municipalities and the dynamics of a municipal golf course is like how much stock is put into the random group of players that show up for whatever meeting and what they say, and how they'll, you know, if you raise the rates, I'm out of here. Is like, is that really the customer that you want? If you I'm giving you a better golf course and it's $10 more, you're out of here, you know.
That's real. And I've been in those meetings where the golf, you know, three or four golfers will get in front of the council and raise their voice and tell the council that they'll never come back. And it scares the council because this is their constituents. They don't want that negativity. So they end up saying, oh, well, we better change our message, or the golfers are going to be upset. And, you know, that's, you know, I find myself, I'm the golfer, right? I'm a golfer, but I also understand, I'm looking at it from a kind of a, you know, I think a bigger picture, and I, you know, losing a customer is a really difficult thing. And I think with all this discussion about technology in the game and the distances and all this evolution of the game, I think one of the biggest things we're going to have a question about is what defines a golfer? What is a traditional golfer, and the challenges of this evolution? You know, you mentioned about bringing your dog out to the course. I couldn't agree more, but I've also seen it where golfers don't like it when two dogs are barking next to each other and they're in their backswing, right? That's the traditional golfer that doesn't want those dogs there. You know, we as an industry are our own worst enemy sometimes.
You got your MBA from Berkeley in 2012. I'm curious. I don't think that's a degree that many architects have. And how has it helped you from your business side?
So, quick clarification: it's not a full MBA. It was an executive education, pretty intense study. But I can't say that I have an MBA. But thank you for giving me that.
I'll always give you.
But if you want to keep saying it, I'll go with it. I will say this: that the two things that I wish I would have learned quicker were that it's not about what you know; it's who you know. It's a relationship business, and then two would be understanding business from how to allocate dollars and how, you know, we talk a lot about a design fee and how much people charge for a design. You know, for a young guy like me, my design you know, generally my design fee has to last almost 2 years because I've got 12 months of design, and then there's going to be a permitting window, and then we might get the whole construction done in 6 months or 12 months. And so, you know, the economic behind, you know, how the dollars and cents of operating a design business, you know, we draw pictures. We're creative people, and typically we're not really good at sales, and we're certainly not good at business by nature. So it's really showed me what I don't know more than it's kind of given me what I do know. So I keep trying to be better at that. Mm-hmm. Business is hard.
Let's transition into one of your more recent projects. You did a restoration renovation of Meadowbrook Golf Club up in Detroit, Michigan area, a Willie Park design. And I think I've gotten countless emails from people saying that it's a spot that I must check out. So tell us a little bit about Meadowbrook and how that job came about.
Sure. Meadowbrook Country Club, Northville, Michigan, about 25 miles or so outside of, about 30 miles outside of Detroit. And it's a private club, family dominated. It's got swim, tennis, active social program. And they chose to undergo some master planning. I think it was in 2013 or 2014 when I first, you know, it was early 14 when I first met them. And they interviewed 15 guys. I happened to get on the list, and we went through a process of elimination. You know, that's the other thing about our business today is it's like, it seems like you're either dealing with one or two guys or you're dealing with 20 guys. So this was one of the ones that you end up just kind of having patience and providing as much information as you can. And I made a few visits where I actually started to get to know some of the people. The general manager, Joe Marini, and I kind of kicked it off right from the beginning. We just kind of got along right away, and it narrowed down to five. And we did a big interview, and I laid out some ideas, and, you know, I focused a lot about how I can sell a plan and be in front of a membership and all my focus group, you know, kind of concept. I have a big portion of my master plan where I get in front of the members and get to know them. And it escalated into a contract, and it was my first project in Michigan, and it was quite a coup for someone from Arizona coming to Michigan. You know, the state of Michigan is pretty specific about who they work with up there. They love their state. And so I'm originally from Wisconsin, so I guess I could play off that I was a Midwesterner by heart, but it couldn't have been better. I can't imagine finding another club that I've gotten along with better and had a better working relationship. And probably more importantly, a club that really trusted me and let me, you know, kind of go through the process and then design a course that I think reflected what we tried, you know, what the club needed and what we wanted to do. It was a Willie Park Jr. original design, but it was only six holes. Willie Park couldn't finish the rest of the course because of financial issues. So Collis and DeRay ended up expanding it from Chicago there. They expanded it to 18 holes.
Those guys did a course up in Chicago called, I think, Glenflora Country Club.
Yeah. No, you know, Olympia Fields, they have some connection there. And then Flossmoor have some connection between the two. And they brought Park over to do Olympia Fields eventually.
The North course.
Yeah, the North course, right.
It's interesting. And so when you get this kind of a project, what kind of research goes into the architects and the history?
Yes, well, a lot. And I think one of the things that I just have an appreciation for, whether or not it's 100 years old or if it's 15 or 20 years old, is let's find some history about why it is what it is. Cause there's always reasons. There's always a permitting issue. There's always a budget issue, or there's something that goes into the process of why that golf course looks the way it does. And so one of the big things about Meadowbrook is you could tell it had been expanded upon over a number of years. And then they ultimately in the '70s did an Art Hills master plan with a couple hole renovation. And Jerry Matthews was another one that had some work on bunkers and a tree planting plan. So they did a fair bit of planting through the '80s.
Excellent.
And so there was a huge amount of history. But one of the things that I clued in on is obviously wondering what it was that Willie Park Jr. really wanted in his 18-hole design, because there's an indication that he did 18-hole design, but we didn't have any drawings for it. And so I dove deep into that. So I looked at his green design. I tried to do as much local history. So yeah, there's a tremendous amount of research that goes into it.
So Willie Park Jr. is, I think, in America a little bit underappreciated, but he has some of the best designs in the UK, and obviously he did, you know, he's Maidstone and Olympia Fields North were two of his designs here. What are some of the traits of a Willie Park course that might get overlooked?
Yeah, Battle Creek outside of Detroit there is another good, really good Willie Park. I think that's one of the better ones. But so to me, it feels like he's very driven on locating his greens. And, you know, so one of the parts of the research is we went over to England and we did as much as we could to see the work in the U.S. But this place called Huntercombe and a place called Sunningdale Old were two places that we knew, or I knew, that I wanted to get a hold of and actually see. And so
Sunningdale's got a little history.
Yeah, just a little bit. It's hard. Well, it was hard for me to figure out exactly how much is still Park versus Colt, but nonetheless, we knew that Huntercombe was his and relatively untouched. And so when you compare what he did in the U.S. and then you look at what we all think is really pretty good indication of what he liked about golf or what he thought he liked. It was a little bit of his experimentation course at Huntercombe. You didn't quite relate. So it was obvious that the courses that he were building here, he was doing a lot of work. He came back in 1915, back from the UK, landed, I think, on tax day in April 15th of 1915. And you see all the courses he was doing at one time. So you know, the whole Donald Ross discussion, how many times can he get to a course? And so the Huntercombe project really resonated with us. You know, so it was a lot more interesting green contours, a lot more diversity. You know, I think Willie Parks tends to do a lot of the same kind of greens. And that's a little, you know, obviously nuances, but, you know, back to front, big, deep swale behind. So he was always very specific about locating his greens. And then at Huntercombe, you know, he did a fair bit of drainage ditches and grass bunkers that didn't have sand in them originally, what they call over there Willie Park pots, mm-hmm. you know, pot bunkers. And so I think for us, we realized that it wasn't all 18-hole, an entire 18-hole Willie Park Jr. at Meadowbrook, and that gave us some latitude to bring some of this flavor from England. And then I had a committee that a couple of them went with me to England to see the work. And we came back to the U.S. and said, man, if we could bring some of that over here, it'd be cool. And I said, let's do it. And so we started to kind of, you know, so I would say it's a sympathetic, I don't know if I'd use the word restoration, but it's sympathetic to Park's work that we saw. But, you know, it was as much of our own interpretation as it was anything that we had any documentation on.
Mm-hmm. It's how important is it to get, you know, your committee out to see stuff when you're undertaking a project like this?
I would tell you it's incredibly important. It's one of the things that continues to be very difficult, because getting everybody in the same place to go travel across the country is time intensive, resource intensive. It's great when you have work locally. So the area around Detroit has a lot of the stuff that we would have wanted to see. But, you know, we went to Pittsburgh, went to Long Island. And so one of our members is very familiar with the North Course at Olympia Fields. And so, you know, it's incredible. It's very important. If nothing else, it's a team building exercise. You actually get a chance to go stand on a green. I remember we went and played Garden City Golf Club. We stood in that, you know, those greens and said, okay, what do we like, what we don't like? And that's a really cool part of the job, I believe, is that, you know, you get to sense what people are comfortable with. And I'll tell you that my committee was really comfortable with doing something cool.
So architecture, I always feel like people have kind of awakening moments at different times. Are there a handful of courses or, you know, one particular golf course that you feel has inspired your career?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a couple of backups, but the number one, without any question, is the Old Course at St. Andrews. And it's one of the things that I was in the business for a while before I actually got over there to see it. So as soon as I saw it, that was my, if you want to call it an awakening. And it was certainly that same question that we all ask. It's like, how in the world did we get so far away from this in the U.S.? And so I got to come back to the Old Course all the time. And then number two is, you know, just understanding the impact that it's had on our business is the Sandhills Golf Club. I mean, that one really started to show you that some of this kind of ethic that you brought from, that you had from the old country of Scotland that was actually coming over here, and it's such a beautiful place to do it in the sand dunes without an ocean, but you got this ocean of dunes. And so I would say those are probably two of the ones that come right to mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got to get over to the Old Course. It's high on the list of things to do, but, Sandhills.
The best part of the Old Course is walking it on Sunday. I mean, well, one of the best parts of the Old Course is getting out there on Sunday and walking around and seeing the greens and watching people walk their dogs and all that stuff. That's just so cool.
When you go out to, say, a site visit for a potential project, what's your prep look like? Do you do a lot of prep before? Do you go walk it blind without knowing it? Like, how does that work?
So one of the things that I always, it's kind of interesting because I've had this happen to me a number of times where I go out and I visit a committee and we go out and walk the golf course, and everybody is looking for me to just start talking, you know, well, I'm looking at this and look at that, when in fact, all I'm doing is just, I'm taking it in. And I think a lot of my feelings of design and my philosophy on design is what does it feel like? I'm visualizing hitting shots. I'm looking at the forms and features are cool, but I'm just taking it in. And so one of the difficult parts that I've always felt one of the difficult parts of what we do is not only looking at it for the first time and seeing it through our eyes, but then knowing how a membership plays it and understanding the differences between the better player versus the average player. And so I've been commented that people will just stop me and say, okay, Andy, what are you saying now? What are you seeing now? You're not saying anything. I'm like, well, I've gotten to the point where I just warn them. I said, guys, don't think that I'm going to talk too much. I'm out here. I'm taking it all in. But overall, it's one of the things that I like about the focus group portion of my process is that I get to know how these guys are actually playing it and not how I would play it. And so, you know, to me, there's a lot of time just understanding how they play it, what they like about it, what they don't like about it, and then start to overlay my own feelings on top of it through that lens. So that to me is there's a lot of time. And when it comes down to the actual ideas, I always talk, I'm an 80-20 guy. I don't know what 80%, 20%. You got to get 80% right or 80% finished, and then 20% you can leave open, kind of open-ended. And that's kind of where my planning always goes, is that, you know, let's get into 80%, but 20% we can start to refine in the field. And sometimes it's 100%. Sometimes you start all over, of course, but I always leave a little bit of my interpretation to kind of evolve when we finally get to construction.
Yeah, with restoration is a big topic with the do you put it all back into place exactly how it was at the best time they determine for the golf course, or do you, you know, modernize it a little bit and move bunkers into where they would have been given technology and distance lengthening? Where do you have a stance on that, or is every situation kind of different?
Yeah, the easy answer is every situation is different, but I would contend that if you're going to call something a restoration, you better be darn sure that it's restored to what was actually built and what it actually was. And mm-hmm. So to me, the word restoration, I kind of laugh on it because, you know, it's one of those words that everyone loves and everyone gets it, but then it becomes so overused. Like, just the idea that someone's restoring something sort of gives it this connotation that it must be exclusive, must be really good. Mm-hmm. And so I'm one that tries to, you know, to understand the logistics of restoration and understand if that's even possible, and even if it's something they want to do. I'm working with a club in California right now. We've had this exact conversation. We've got a really good aerial that shows some the golf course in a state that a couple of really famous architects have worked on it. And we said, hey, do we want to restore to this? And some of it's not possible. And then, you know, then we have those bunkers that are 180 yards off the tee, right in the landing area of Mrs. Jones and those types of things. So what I've tried to do is I always try to go back in and restore the location of that bunker and give it the feeling that there was a bunker there, but I'll maybe soften it, make it rough, but make it part of the composition of the golf hole, not necessarily put bunkers back, but then use mowing lines and try to do something in turf to actually accentuate what that course was like, and not necessarily, if we're not going down the restoration tack. But I always like to pay homage to those old features, even if it's a little bump off in the rough that only me and the superintendent know about. At least we know that that's where it was.
What's your pet peeve at a golf course? I've got mine. I'm just curious what yours are.
Where do I start? Green speeds. I can't tell you how many golf courses I know that consume way too much energy and too much thought and resources around trying to get speeds to a certain level. And then I would also say one of my pet peeves personally is this idea of designing courses for the better player while making them playable and interesting for the average player. And, you know, to me that sounds so easy to do when you apply those to a particular piece of property, and especially a renovation that has limitations. Playing the right set of tees is so important. And so from a golfing standpoint, the idea that any man would ultimately move forward to a set of tees that aren't, you know, in his wheelhouse, to me, that's a major pet peeve. But all of the things around length and teeing grounds is something that I probably would describe as a pet peeve.
Yeah, it's funny. I played golf with a guy that I've played golf with like dozens of times in Florida recently. He's an older guy, and yeah, he likes playing back with me he's a guy that's played in a ton of USGA events. Like this guy's a stick. He was, you know, one of the best players in Ohio for a long time and as an am. And it's funny, he's getting, I think he's close to 70 now, but we played and we had another older guy in the group and he played way up. I mean, he played under 6,000 yards, 5,700 yards. And like all of a sudden, like this guy was a stick again. And it's like, right. And I talked to him about it. He's like, I love it. Like I play like I used to play because I'm hitting shots and I'm getting birdie putts. When I hit a good drive, I've got a short iron in. When I hit, you know, on longer par fours, I've got long iron, mid irons, but I'm not just chipping up all the time anymore. Like he can go play in the back tees and shoot 76, 78, but now he can shoot in the 60s every time if he plays up.
Awesome.
And it's just more fun.
Yeah. So but going back to Meadowbrook for a second, there were some people, some gals on our committee and in the focus groups that thought the game of golf was meant to be played driver three wood on every par four and par five. And in some cases, driver on every par three. That's what they thought golf was. And when you start to think about that there's a whole generation of golfers that have not been able to experience the game the way that we talk about, you know, the driver short iron or a drivable hole. You know, they think of a drivable hole being a par three. It's crazy.
I think that playing the right tee is like one of the biggest epidemics in American golf. In United Kingdom, just there's so many golf courses that are like, you know, 5,600 yards. That's fine, right?
Well, that's the difference. That's the difference where because there's this discussion about how many teeing grounds on a golf hole are too many. Is three the right number? Is four? Is five? Oh my gosh, we can't do six. That's way too many. Well, that only happens when you get yardages above the 6,300 yard mark. You know, a lot of these, even if you get to 6,600 yard, you might have a little small little back tee, but you know, it's now when you go from 7,300 yards all the way down to 4,000, which is what I'm trying to do, is try to get this diversification. It's hard to make a golf hole look classic and like it fits with all these little pads. So that's one of the things that I think we're really, you know, we're really working hard to give that diversity. And, you know, combo sets of tees are really popular in my world, where you can only, you know, only have to build three or four sets of tees, maybe one's all the way up in the fairway, so you're not really mowing that as a tee, and then combo in between so that you have the right yardage that you're looking for, but you're only utilizing three tees. To me, that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, playing more tees and different tees on different holes, like, is only going to add to the variety of the golf course, especially if you play the course on a daily basis or a regular basis.
Totally agree. So Sand Hollow, I worked on this project in St. George, Utah, Sand Hollow. And when I take friends there, I never play from the scorecard. We always have a game. You know, not all my friends are all great players, but, you know, well, I'm not a great player, but I mean, some of them are lesser than I am, but I'll take them to a set of tees to say, okay, this is what we were thinking about here, and this is where you play it now. And then it's 27 holes, and one of the nines is a kind of open all mode together concept called the Lynx Nine. And we specifically intended that course to be played from multiple sets of tees so that you could have a different feeling as you played it through. So to me, I never go back to my courses and actually play from the card. I will always take my friends, especially if it's only one time. All right, guys, let's go play from this tee, because this is where it really, based on who I'm playing with, this is exactly how it was meant to be played. And to me, that, you know, of course, that's a little inside knowledge from my standpoint, but it's not very well accepted and not well practiced within our industry, for sure.
We talked about Bandon Dunes earlier, and I mean, I think that was one of the big philosophies of that whole place, was like designing a golf course around at a yardage where people would enjoy golf.
Absolutely.
I mean, those courses
are
shorter.
Even the original course, they've even added some tees going forward. You know, my friend Art Little has been a part up there helping out with this idea of relating swing speed to actual yardage on a golf course. And when you actually use something somewhat technical like that, you start to say, okay, you know, there's certain limitations for actual abilities based on how you're swinging and how far you could actually carry the ball. Because that's a lot of what it comes down to, is these forced carries or getting up to the fairways. So yeah, but I couldn't agree more. They've done a great job of, you know, now they even funnel everybody right to the 63 or 6,200 yard golf course.
Mm-hmm. You got your start in the industry in a role for a construction company that is regularly contracted to do work. And I'm curious your take on kind of this design build and versus design contract. Not really schism, is, I don't know if that's the right word, but debate that is, you know, prevalent in golf course architecture.
Well, that's a big discussion. So anybody who's worked in a really, you know, a good open design build relationship where nobody on the team is going to get penalized, and there's not a major schedule. It's not that we're milking time or whatever, but the design build is by far the best way to get results and certainly have, you know, some pretty good fun doing it. Where the design contract starts to become you know, more of a role, and there's a lot of talk about design build and how, you know, in the 20, 30 years ago, architects would draw plans and then hand them over to a contractor. You know, I get that. And in a lot of cases, I've been a part of some projects like that, but that happened for, I think, a real reason. Even today, even when you're doing a design build, you're still having to have a contractor as part of the team. I've yet, even today, you know, to find those, you know, that's what we did at Sand Hollow. We had everyone on a time and materials, and we started the project, and we didn't stop until we were happy with it. But that is so rare these days. Owners want budgets. They want timeframes. Certainly on a renovation schedule, they only want to be closed for a certain part of the season or only one season, and that's it, or else it's not going to pass. And so contractors start to bring the ability for architects to meet those goals. And I think, to me, when you apply, then when you apply the actual business of design and being able to only have a certain amount of time in your schedule, that, you know, to be able to spend 100% of your time on a golf course, you know, that limits you on a lot of other areas. So what I've done is I've set my, I try to include design shaping in part of my contract. I've got a guy that I've done a lot of work with. His name's Scott Clem, but an architecture geek. He understands it from what we're all trying to accomplish. But I've got other guys that I've worked with. I always try to have somebody there to support me. But I think as long as you're able to spend the right amount of time in the field, which is what I always try to do, even though I'm not on a piece of equipment. However, I have operated. I just don't anymore. And so, those guys are a lot better at it than I am. And so, you know, the designed contract works for me in the times that clients dictate it. And then I'm able to spend a lot of time in the field. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but there's a lot there on that discussion. You know, I've always wondered, for guys that are really promoting design build, you know, especially when, you know, the self operators, you know, I just think of it in my own time. You know, I've got a family, I've got three young boys are playing baseball, you know, so I prefer to try to get it in a position where I work with contractors on a regular basis or shapers on a regular basis. Cause you know, Scott goes, you know, at months at a time at certain places when it's the right project. But the design build has its own limitations, and there's only so much time in a day that if you're going to want to do multiple projects, or if you're lucky enough to have multiple projects going on at one time, the design build gets a lot more difficult when you spread yourself thin.
Is the efficiencies of running a business, it definitely hinders how many projects you can take on. I think there's a huge value to, you know, the design build and the work. It's a fascinating aspect because, you know, I think everything in all of the world kind of tends to swing on pendulums, you know, and in the 80s and early 90s, it was way over on the contractor side. You know, this is the way to do it, you know.
What I'd say about that, though, you know, one of the things that I have to say about the contractor side is that, you know, because the business became so busy, you now have a lot of people building golf courses who don't even play golf.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I feel. You talk a lot about the dark ages, you know, we maybe referenced that before. You know, a lot of it is people just didn't understand the game. And you're asking somebody to put a little curl in a green, a little wrinkle, a little bump. And, you know, Scott and I will shape it in and we'll try to get it in there right. And, you know, I'll even be out there with my rake and shovel and getting it exactly right. And then the finish crew comes through and wipes it out because, you know, the last 10 Fazio jobs they've done, that was something that got wiped out. We removed it. Well, no, that was something I specifically wanted there and they'd never seen it before. And so to me, what the design build concept today is really doing is it's putting the focus back on understanding the game of golf. Yeah. To me, that's what's really cool about it. You know, and I think you can get there, you know, back to that 80-20 rule. We need to make it at least 80% right. Now the question is how much of that 20%, I try to get as close to 100% as I possibly can. And the only way to get 100% is actually being there, doing it yourself, design building. But then again, if I'm there for the last 2 months doing that, more than likely I missed out on another RFP. I wasn't able to make a visit to go inquire about this other project. And, oh, by the way, I just missed 3 baseball games. And so, you know, life happens in between there. And to me, that's where I wonder how the design build will stand up from a business standpoint, because the contracting happened for a reason, and that was to be able to do a lot of golf over a very short period of time. Now we've swung back the other way to your analogy with the pendulum. I just wonder how much we're going to actually be able to, whether the design build will actually be a sustainable model for guys like me.
I think it ends up settling somewhere in the middle where, you know, there's a role of each, and different projects call for different methods, you know?
Yep.
I think. Yeah.
Well, and I think a $5 million renovation is a lot different than a $600,000 bunker project, right? So I think to me, scale and logistics start to play right in line with, you know, the right construction process. Do you need this kind of contractor with this kind of financial sense, you know, or for financial backing to be able to get this project done? I went back to Meadowbrook and I went to them and I said, you know, guys, if you're asking me how to do this right, we should design build and get a contractor to help support us and bring in some support staff and put everybody on a time and materials so that there's no feeling of, you know, of everybody getting, you know, lost or losing. And the president of the club at the time said, Andy, we just can't do that. We need a number. We need to go to the membership with a number. And I said, well, I can give you a number. Yeah, but we don't have a contract that says that it's not going to exceed that. Well, no, it's a time and materials, but yet we're going to manage this. It just didn't fly. Now, looking back, he looks at it, he says, oh, now I see what you're saying. That would have been some value there, but there's no way I could have convinced Meadowbrook to do that. They're just, so we picked our battle and we design contracted it. Scott, and another couple of guys were shapers on it. And then, we had a contractor, you know, doing the heavy lifting.
Let's get into some lighter stuff.
All right.
All right. Who do you consider the least appreciated architect?
Least appreciated.
Underappreciated would be.
Underappreciated. You know, I go back to a guy like Perry Maxwell. I know he's probably gained a little bit more traction in our architectural world than he has in years past, but I got a chance when I lived back in Arkansas and Oklahoma and Texas, I got a chance to see some of his stuff, and he built, you know, in today's world, he would have been able to build golf courses for almost nothing. He was a great router of golf courses and did things in the Depression that is probably equal to or greater than what we did through our own Great Recession. So I'm going to say Perry Maxwell.
All right. What's your favorite design feature that flies under the radar?
Chocolate drops.
I think that's misunderstood.
You know, I'm a guy that when you go see a place like Garden City Golf Club or even go to Huntercombe and see these old school kind of, you know, you excavate and then put a pile of dirt and it just has fescue growing on the top of it. And there's three or four or five of them in that area and they become part of the aesthetic of the whole course and the hazard and the strategy. So those, I love stream features and I love rock walls. I love things that are able to make something look interesting and authentic and maybe old. And I think a good old fashioned chocolate drop does that.
You like artificial rock walls?
Well, if they're done in a way, we did these series. I like them when they're done when someone thinks they're 100 years old. So we did this.
I was getting that. I was hoping that was going to be the response.
We did a rock wall behind the first green and along the second tee at Meadowbrook. I did a lava rock wall at Sand Hollow. We imported this lava from like 3 miles away, and everybody who sees it thinks it's been there 100 years. So we work really hard to make it look cool.
Nothing drives me more than seeing like a brand new rock wall that like you can tell was just installed and just is like screams like waste of money.
Yeah. So one of the best parts of this rock wall that we did at Sand Hollow is we stacked them all up. And then we'd go periodically with an excavator and push it over. I'm like, yes, that's right. It fell over right there. So, and we go to the next spot. And then we took sand and blew it up over the top of it. You know, we crossed one of the holes at Sand Hollow right in front of the second tee on the links course. So it was right in front of the tees. So the average guy could skip it over the wall. So we actually piled up and ramped up the sand as if it was a dune that kind of blew over the wall.
All right. You ready for overrated, underrated?
Yeah, I guess so. Let's do this.
All right. Cross bunkers.
Cross bunkers. Well, I would call them underrated in the fact that people just don't appreciate why they're there. And it's kind of a signal on what's happened with the game of golf where if a cross bunker is 180 yards off the tee and everyone hits into it, the idea that you should have played around it has been lost. So I guess I'll call cross bunkers underrated because they for a period of time they just all but disappeared on our golf courses. But slowly with this restoration, you kind of you know, where restoration has been going, that you're seeing a lot of them come back.
Yeah, I agree. They I feel like a lot of them fell to mowing lines shrinking also.
Well, I think a lot of them are on the tee, but the ones that I'm having some really good success bringing back are the ones that are short of the greens. And when golfers actually see that they're there to distort, you know, and that the better player has an equal problem with seeing where it heads, where how far it is from the green, and whether or not they know it's further away, but yet it still kind of gets them thinking. And so that 50-yard bunker off of the green on the, you know, off of the green and the approach bunkers, I'm starting to see those starting to gain some really good traction, which I'm really happy about.
You know, I lost my yardage gun a few months ago, and
I'm sorry about that.
Well, to tell you the truth, I've like really enjoyed playing golf without it, like especially great. When I go to new golf courses.
Because yeah, I don't have one of those. They, I don't have any of those.
I get tricked all the time.
Well, I think one of the things that we could do in the rules of golf, as we start to bring on this new ball or whatever's going to happen with technology and distance, is to allow or to try to promote, you know, six club, nine club, something, you know, 12, you know, 11 club, something other than 14. So you get into the tweener shots where you're actually hitting a 7-iron from 140 yards. And when you start doing some of those things, those four bunkers really become interesting. And you actually use them because you know why they're there. You just hit them over the top of it and it runs it out. Mm-hmm. So I love – it's one of the things as a golfer I try to do more of it. You know, it's harder nowadays because it's rare when – well, I shouldn't say rare, but it, you know, a lot of golf courses don't allow for the runouts anymore. We're trying to get that change. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you catch that backside of a bunker that's 20 yards short and you get the – it's like a springboard that kicks it right to the green. That's one of the cool things that I feel like has been lost with the way the game's changed in terms of the aerial game, is that all these, like, especially when you go to these golden age courses, all these cool little slopes that are short of the green that just don't get it used anymore, or if they haven't been, you know, if the mow lines are off or just sitting there in rough.
That's right. Well, one of the things that I feel really proud about is the people that have open their minds to some of the features we did up at Meadowbrook, is that the guys and gals that are struggling are recovering around the greens like they always do, just a sand wedge and try to get it up and stop near the hole. But when you start seeing the different, you know, different backstops and the places for it to feed down into different pins, people, you know, I had a guy the other day say, "Hey, Andy, I played Meadowbrook last fall. You want to know what I thought of it?" I said, "Yeah, of course." He says, "I thought it was fun. Is that all right that I thought it was fun?" I'm like, "Heck yeah, that's exactly right." And the guys who open their minds to those types of shots are just fun.
Yeah, that's I mean, like, I like to hit like punch drivers on when I play a Baritz hole that's like a rainer now, just so I can see the ball run through the
trend.
Yeah, and run up to the bat. Like a lot of times, I end up making a bogey because. but I don't really care because like I had
but
more
you're
fun.
Happy with that. I mean, yeah. You played it, you tried it, absolutely, yeah,
exactly.
Makes the par even better, or a birdie even better.
Yeah, it's all right. Next, overrated, underrated, cart pass.
Cart pass. Well, they're certainly not underrated. I'd call them overrated.
All right.
I think you're finding a lot more people being open to other alternatives. I think people get where we're coming from a design standpoint more than just a few years ago. So I think that's certainly overrated, and I think it's trending in the right direction.
I think my pet peeve, like the ultimate one that bugs me the most, is when you see a cart path at like a old school golf course that's running down where the fairway should be.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. What comes right to mind is one of the courses we went to go visit in England was Swinley Forest. And I guess I shouldn't pick on Swinley, but, you know, a lot of those UK courses, when you think about how cart paths have evolved, they didn't have cart paths. So then all of a sudden people started driving these buggies, and they all drove in the exact same spot, and then they drove in a straight line. So oftentimes they go right down the middle of the fairway, and then what do you do next? Well, there's a path there. We better put some paving, or we might better put some gravel, as opposed to someone saying, you know what? We don't want them to go there. We want them to go over here so we don't see the path. And so a lot of times you get to these old courses, the cart paths are no different place than where it was when they first got their first cart path, you know, first golf carts. And so, you know, one of our committee members said, yeah, Andy, you talk about cart paths, but look at this place. This is a Swinley Forest. They're right in the middle of the fairway. So, but I agree with you. The less you see a cart path, the better.
Would it be, I just was thinking about this as like, could you go no cart path, but then just change like, you know, the signs and would that work or would that just not work? You know, like I think it, yeah, never. Would it work?
You know? Well, no. I mean, it would work in some places, but I mean, the reason why there's cart paths is because everyone drives in the same exact spot and it gets compacted and it wears out the turf. And then next thing you know, it has a low spot and it becomes mud. So, you know, there's cart paths for a reason, is because we have a thing called a golf cart. So if, as long as we have golf carts, there's going to have to be paths. And I think if as long as we just, you know, there's a way to do them well. And I think it's one of the things we spend an exorbitant amount of time thinking about, probably more than we'd like to. I'd hope to one day not to do a golf project without cart paths.
Do you think it could work at a community golf level? No cart path, no carts, golf course.
Well, you certainly could try. I think ultimately you're going to end up getting into something where everyone rides in the exact same spot. You'd end up having to.
I'm saying no carts completely.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I could. I think there's got to be a commitment to kind of going back to the caddies and golf push carts, the trolleys, if you will. You know, that's the other thing too. A pet peeve is this idea that push carts or trolleys are muni golf, that they're not worthy of the top clubs in the country. And that I think that it all kind of goes to this erosion of the caddies and walking and, you know, pushing your cart, carrying your bag, those types of things. So I think there'd have to be a concerted effort to be more health conscious and exercise and really utilize the fact that carrying your bag is like a workout. And it's the only workout I get these days is carrying my bag. I got a cool little McKinsey bag. I'm almost always the only one walking whenever everyone else is on a golf cart. And I'm like, well, this is my exercise.
Yeah. So, I was really tired on my recent trip with Zach through Northern California. And, you know, I'd played an exorbitant amount of golf over a few days. And Zach's like, you should just ride. We were at Monterey Peninsula Club. And I was like, you know, man, I don't think I can. my listeners would be upset with me if they saw me riding on a seaside course on a 70 degree day.
Here's a model that I think needs to be thought of more is a golf cart with four or five places for carts where someone drives it.
Yeah.
And that way, you know, someone's not, you know, you're not using two or four caddies and you got a golf cart and then someone's driving it where they're supposed to drive it. That's part of the reason why golf carts, you get in trouble, is because you just can't control where people drive carts these days. They just drive them everywhere. So that's where you have these issues. But I played a little par three course here. You know, they funneled us right into a golf cart on a par three course. and it was a four seater and my buddies were like, yeah, a four seater. And we put all of our bags on there, and I walked alongside of them. And so I think we do have an opportunity to kind of look outside the box. I think if there's more of a concerted effort to do something other than just ram everybody in carts, I think there's things that can work.
Last overrated, underrated, music on the golf course.
Oh, man, totally underrated. I think I've never been – you would never have thought that would have brought up so many passionate – feelings about whether or not loud music on a course is good or bad. I love it. You know, of course it's a little harder to be having music on the course when you don't have a golf cart. You know, someone carrying a speaker along with you is a little bit different, kind of muffled in your bag, but headphones, I think it's an integral part, and I think it's just a matter of time before we start to see it everywhere.
Yeah. What do you listen to?
What music do I listen to?
Yeah, what would be your go-to?
You know, You know, I'm still on the 21 Pilots recently, so I can't get off of that. But I'm an 80s guy, so I go back to U2. I go back to Midnight Oil. That's another good one.
Mm-hmm. Chili Peppers?
What's that?
Was Chili Peppers your time? Chili Peppers, yeah. They're coming up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I like Chili Peppers. That's not a go-to, but it's definitely in my music list.
Uh-huh. The 80s. Yeah, I've always wanted. I got to do an Architect comparison to bands from like the golden age.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is, so I was at a conference through Marriott Golf the other day, and so I was a speaker on one of their panels, and every time one of their guys got up on stage, they picked their own entrance music, and I'm like, that is awesome. And it's like, we have so many opportunities to make to create our own entrance music. Why don't we do that? So I was thinking the next interview that I have, I was going to try to figure out how to play in, you know, Enter Sandman from Metallica or something like that as my entrance music.
The PGA Tour is doing it at Zurich now.
There it is.
Yeah.
See?
Becoming more and more prevalent. So, hey, Andy, thanks so much for your time. It's been a good talk, and we'll have to have you on again.
All right. Anytime, man. I enjoy what you're doing. You're doing it the right way, I think, and I'm honored to be a part of it. So thanks again.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.